Our second case this morning is United States against DiPaolo, counsel for the defense.
Good morning. May it please the court, I am Captain Bobby Kaza, and I represent the appellant in this case, Petty Officer Michael DiPaolo. Chief Judge Efron, with your permission, I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Granted.
The evidence brought forth in the record in this case demonstrates that on the night of the incident in question, Petty Officer DiPaolo believed he was engaged in a consensual seduction with a sexual partner, a consensual back and forth. Petty Officer DiPaolo believed that he would be able to have sexual contact with a partner who he had sexual contact with on several previous occasions. The alleged victim in this case, E.D., did say no initially to having sexual intercourse when he first asked her. However, subsequent to her saying no to sexual intercourse, her actions and her conduct made it clear to Petty Officer DiPaolo that she was consenting to something less than sexual intercourse, and perhaps sexual intercourse would still be available. Specifically, by her own testimony, after first saying no to sexual intercourse, she subsequently kissed the appellant back, went onto the bed with the appellant, allowed her shirt to be taken off while she was on top of the appellant, allowed the appellant to kiss her bare chest.
Do you have Willis before you by any chance? Case Willis?
I know the case, Your Honor. I don't have a print copy.
And in Willis, there's three arguments presented in paragraph 7 as to why the instruction didn't need to be given in Willis. In the off chance that you've memorized those arguments, can you run through each and apply them to this case? Or I can state them and then you can reply.
If I remember correctly, Your Honor, in that case, the appellant in that case had sexual intercourse with the victim who was alleged to be unconscious at the time. The appellant's version of events was that she was a willing sexual partner.
Right. I don't want to argue facts. I want to argue at all. I just want to see what your responses are.
Yes, sir.
The court said, first, the record clearly reflects that appellant's theory of trial was that the prosecutrix was fully awake and fully consented to the initiation of the act. No possibility of mistake was even hinted. Is that this case, yes or no, and why?
No, Your Honor. In this case, the theory was not that it was an unambiguous consent. Civilian Defense Counsel conceded in his opening and closing that the victim on numerous occasions said no. That was never a contested issue that the victim did say no on several occasions. The contested issue in this case, unlike in Willis, was in what context should that no have been understood by the appellant. So that the actual consent doctrine brought forth in Willis would not apply in this case.
Well, even if the theory at trial was that she actually consented, wouldn't he have to believe that she consented to be able to get a mistake of fact defense instruction?
That is correct, Your Honor. There's two prongs to the instruction, the objective and the subjective portion. Again, in Willis, one of the other pieces they talked about is the
subjective. That was the next of the three arguments.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
The subjective piece to that, the court acknowledged that the circumstances testified to, brought forth by Willis, that the victim had danced with him previously that night and may have taken some other actions were consensual. The court acknowledged that perhaps, objectively speaking, an outside observer could look at those and say, well, maybe this would give him some belief in consent. However, there was nothing to indicate what he actually believed internally. That is not a problem in this case. We do have evidence in the record of what the appellant believed to inform upon his subjective belief.
Where in the statement is there a subjective belief that she consented?
The NCIS statement, Your Honor, that's probably in that paragraph, towards the end of that paragraph, the appellant testifies, I came to understand she was not going to change her mind. That's some evidence of his subjective belief that the previous no's that she'd been saying had not been unambiguous, no further sexual contact.
But if it was ambiguous, then she wouldn't have had to change her mind.
Correct. I understand your question, Your Honor. His interpretation, or at least the record reflects his interpretation of her no's were meaning no sexual intercourse, as in full intercourse. However, they did not mean no sexual contact. I mean the kissing, the fondling, and the seduction that was going on prior to that. So he understood those no's to mean, okay, I can't, this means no sexual intercourse, but I still have consent to try to seduce her and to do the sexual contact that we're engaging in right now.
Didn't this couple have a history?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, and hadn't he always backed off when she said no before?
That was her testimony, Your Honor. However, if you actually look at the telephone intercept of the conversation after the incident.
Oh, the seductive ouch?
Yes, Your Honor, there's a seductive ouch. And also, on the joint appendix at page 20, the victim is talking to the appellant, and she says, usually you quit after the first couple of no's. And then he says after that, well, sometimes it takes a lot of no's. So I think that right there is some evidence that perhaps prior to this incident in question, there was times where she would say, no several times before it would stop. Again, now, is that compelling or convincing? That's not necessarily the standard. The standard before us is there's some evidence.
Counsel, do you have further problems?
That's actually me, but you go first.
Which precise touching are you contesting here with respect to the requirement for the instruction? In other words, which touching of which he was convicted is the subject of his reasonable belief that there was consent or mistake of fact as consent?
All of the specification is pretty specific when it comes to the touchings, includes the kissing of the breast, fondling, getting on top of her, grinding against her. The appellant's position is that all of that occurred prior to him understanding that her no didn't just mean no sexual intercourse. It meant no more sexual contact at all. All of the language in that specification refers to the seductive act prior to that.
What about his statement, she continued to say no to all of my advances? I'm back in the statement.
Yes, Your Honor. I think it's important to look at that statement in the context of the record and looking at the victim's testimony during the trial, where it was brought out on cross-examination that interspersed throughout her no's was her taking, by her own testimony, consensual acts, and also intermixed with laughter on the part of the appellant, to where he thought.
But how does that reflect a subjective belief on his part?
Well, the fact that
may go to whether it's a reasonable belief.
The fact that he's laughing, Your Honor, goes to his subjective belief that he believes that this to be a consensual back and forth. So the laughter, and then the telephone intercept afterwards, where he expresses surprise that it was as negative experience as she says it was, and said, I'm talking about the stuff with ouch. He says, I didn't mean, if I did something, it wasn't in a mean way. It's him saying, I wasn't trying to be mean.
He thought no meant no. He just thought if he persisted and pestered her enough, maybe she'd turn around and say yes.
Well, I think he understood.
How does that go to mistake?
I think it's important to know he never had sexual intercourse with her. He wasn't charged with rape. They never had the sexual intercourse. What he was charged with and the facts before the court were the seductive part of that prior to that, when he was trying to get her to have sexual intercourse.
And he persisted in the face of her nose because he thought maybe if he pestered her long enough, she'd give in.
She would give in and have sexual intercourse.
Right.
His interpretation of the nose, however, was for the sexual intercourse that might happen further down the line, not on what he was presently doing with her on the bed.
Counsel, do we know that from the record, or is that an inference that you're drawing from the record?
That's an inference that can be drawn, Your Honor.
Right, because here, what evidence is there in the record of his particular statements? You got the statement that he gave to law enforcement. You've got the intercept. What else?
There's the statement he gave to NCIS. There's his laughter during the actual incident. The testimony.
That's her testimony.
Her testimony, right? But that is some evidence of his state of mind, that he was laughing. And then, of course, the telephone intercept finally after the fact.
And no testimony from him.
Correct.
It's a consensual monitoring, not an intercept.
Yeah.
Right? Let's be clear.
Yes, Your Honor.
And in this case, did he have a constitutional and statutory right not to testify?
He did, Your Honor.
And in that circumstance, was there any obligation on his part to affirmatively introduce further evidence as to his subjective belief?
No, Your Honor. Under United States versus Jones, it's clear that an accused does not need to testify to get a mistake of fact instruction. Now, of course, there is the objective and the subjective piece. And certainly for the subjective piece, it would be helpful to have an appellant or accused testify.
But when we're looking at the subjective piece, do we take into account his exercise of both his statutory and constitutional right not to testify?
Well, I think under United States versus Jones, that can't be held against him. Obviously, the way that...
I'm not talking about holding it against him. I'm talking about, does that operate in his favor? That is, he could have testified as to his subjective belief. But the fact that he didn't testify, does that require us in this case to look at all the facts that are otherwise available in the context of a person who has exercised his constitutional and statutory rights?
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree with that. So the evidence brought forth in the statement from the victim's testimony and the telephone monitoring are sufficient to demonstrate the appellant's subjective belief that he had consent to engage in and what he engaged in, which was, again, short of sexual intercourse. It was sexual contact prior to that, by the victim's testimony, portions of which were consensual after she said no. In addition, the defense theory of the case was not predicated on actual consent. It was predicated on the victim did say no, but it was ambiguous as to what that no meant or as to how the appellant understood that. Accordingly, the civilian defense counsel requested the mistake of fact instruction be given to the members. The military judge improperly applied the law in refusing to give that instruction. Further, the lower court applied an improper standard when assessing that error, and actually, in the opinion, indicates that the military judge did not abuse his discretion, which indicates it was applying the abuse of discretion standard as opposed to a de novo standard. So that was incorrect. And of course, the lower court, I think somewhat cryptically, acknowledges that there may have been very little evidence of honest and reasonable mistake of fact, but that was not enough for the sum evidence standard. So I think the evidence is very significant and compelling that there was a legal error in this case. And the analysis then turns to the question of harmless error. And was this, as this is a constitutional error regarding an affirmative defense, the standard is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. When there has been an instructional error, the Supreme Court in Nieder versus United States admonishes appellate courts to tread very lightly to ensure that they do not invade the province of the members and are not themselves determining whether or not the appellant was guilty or innocent, simply whether it's possible a reasonable finder of fact could, in fact, have ruled in his favor on that issue. In this case, where the legal issue has been contested, it was part of the defense theory of the case. There was evidence put on that from both the government and defense that the jury could have chosen either side to give credit to. It's very difficult to say it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt without invading the province of the members.
What would you point to specifically in terms of the evidence that was presented either to the members or argument presented to the members where the defense specifically brought to their attention this matter as a contested matter in the case?
Yes, sir. I think if you look at, we've got the closing argument from Civilian Defense Counsel. He says, when I hear the government say no means no, even a child understands that. Not if you've been saying yes to the child. You suddenly say no, that doesn't mean that the child understands. And with adults, it's even more complicated because you have someone like the victim, ED, saying yes, 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 no once, yes, yes, yes. And therefore, when the government makes the argument, if you say no, that's the end of it. We all know that's not the case, and that's an oversimplification of all human behavior. So they're referring to the complexities of human behavior, and the ambiguity that no squarely puts the issue of mistake of fact before the members. And again, there's reference to that in the opening statement as well. Therefore, in light of the evidence that's in the record, it's a very low standard of some evidence. And the question before this court is not whether or not the appellant is guilty or not guilty, whether or not he has compelling or convincing evidence that he had a mistake of fact. The question is, was there some evidence before in the record? And was that error harmless beyond a reasonable doubt? Looking at the record as a whole, I think it's clear that there was some evidence that the members could conceivably have given credit to, and this error was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. If there are no further questions, that concludes my argument at this time.
Thank you, counsel. We have an opportunity to rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
Good morning, Chief Judge. May it please the Court. My name is Major Elizabeth Harvey, and along with Colonel Louis Pulio, I represent the United States in this case. No evidence of appellant's honest, subjective, mistaken belief of Edie's consent was presented at trial, and therefore no mistake of fact instruction was required.
What's your response to the appellant's argument with respect to the statement that sex equals intercourse, and that so when he's saying, she's saying no, 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 she's no, saying no to intercourse, but not necessarily no to whatever happened before that?
Your Honor, I would point to the line in his statement that says that she continued to say no to all of my advances, and as an illustration of the fact that, he understood that she didn't want it to continue at all past the consensual portion of the beginning of the encounter.
The appellant might argue that that cuts to the whether it is a persuasive argument, but that here there's enough ambiguity as to what no was reaching to put it into play.
Right, when this statement is read alongside the testimony by ED that it was not just her saying no, but that as he pinned her wrists above her head, that she was trying to pull her hands out, that she managed to pull one hand out, that he was trying to unzip her pants, and that she was zipping it back
but
up.
But does not her testimony indicate that at least some activities were consensual?
Yes, Your Honor.
So which activities, do we know which activities he's being held criminally liable for? Is he being held criminally liable for the ones she described as consensual?
No, Your Honor.
How do we know that?
Your Honor, because the activity beyond the point where she consented, everything that is in the charge continued to occur following the point where she said that she consented. She said she consented to kissing. She said she consented when he removed her shirt when she was laying on top of him. And then she said that he rolled her over, he pinned her, the wrists above her head, and at that point, the remainder of the encounter, which he describes as lasting, or it's described by various parties as lasting more from 45 minutes to an hour and a half, she was saying no, she was trying to get out from under him, she was kneeing him.
So in your view, all the factual events in the charge occurred post holding wrists down?
Yes, sir.
And where in the record is that brought to the attention of the members that those are the acts that are at issue, that they're post holding wrists down? Was that in the instruction? In other words, how do we know what the members convicted him of in that entire series of acts?
Well, Your Honor, we know that they didn't find him guilty by exceptions and substitution. So, although...
But some of those acts that are charged occurred, described, some of those acts in the charge sheet describe things that occurred before the holding down with arms.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe the kissing, she described kissing consensually with him before, and that was charged. Yes,
So what's your response to my question? Were those acts before or after the wrist holding down?
We under our contention is that they continued throughout this encounter, and at a certain point, pretty early on, she wanted it to end, and she made that clear to him, and he didn't stop.
And where did she say no touching?
Your Honor, she said no to each of his, she said no, she didn't want to have sex with him, and then as he continued to do these things, she was physically resisting as well as saying no continuously as he continued to, when she said she didn't want to have sex, he didn't just continue to kiss her or engage in petting. He was attempting to accomplish sexual intercourse. He didn't get there, but he was trying to pull her pants down. He was trying to hold her arms over her head. He was trying to take her pants off, and he was simulating sex. He was putting her legs up on his shoulders. So she was saying no to sex. He was trying to get to sex. She was saying no and trying to stop the encounter.
Well, wasn't there some evidence, at least in front of the members, that while she was saying no, that there was also joking and laughing going on?
Yes, Your Honor. It's unclear where in the encounter that occurred.
Okay, well, let's assume that evidence is in front of the members, okay? And so they don't get a mistake of fact instruction, and and so they think, okay, well, we don't believe that she did consent because she says that she says no. But why couldn't they have believed that it was reasonable, that it was objectively reasonable, and that he honestly believed that she was horsing around and that she, that he believed that she consented? I mean, why, if they've been given that instruction, why couldn't they have believed that?
Your Honor,
because, I mean, right, there's a couple different defenses. She actually consented.
Yes, sir.
She didn't actually consent, but I thought that she did, and someone else in my shoes would have thought she did, too. Or it didn't happen, all right? It didn't happen is off the table, so we have the other two defenses.
Yes, Your Honor, and the defense presented at the time is that this is all evidence that she actually consented.
And I understand that. What I'm saying, though, is if they didn't believe that, why couldn't they have said, but we believe that he thought that she consented?
Your Honor, the portion of time in which she was laughing and he was begging her is, perhaps they might believe that at that moment in time she was consenting, but as it went on beyond that,
the members don't have to believe that she was actually consenting for mistake of fact, right? They just have to believe that he reasonably believed that she was consenting, and that someone else in his situation with his history would have also believed that she was consenting.
Your Honor, the history between the two was that when she said no, that she meant no, and that he would stop, and he had in the past. And so, even if at one point they were joking around about whether or not she was going to succumb and she was going to actually have sex with him, as he continued and as he got rougher with her and as he continued to push and push and attempt to have sex with her, and she was saying no, there's no evidence during that period of time that he subjectively believed that she consented.
Did the history of the couple's relationship indicate that in the past he had stopped when she said no to anything, or just to intercourse, or what?
Your Honor, the evidence from E.D. and her direct, on page 37 of the joint appendix, said, had he asked you for sex before? Yes. And you had said no, yes. And what was the result of that? He wouldn't do it. He'd stop. So it's not clear, but saying he would stop certainly sounds as though he would stop all activity. And we know that 3 days prior to this incident, when he came over, she was sick, and they didn't engage in any sexual activity at all.
Doesn't that reflect part of the misunderstanding of the military judge in this case as to what the requirements are for mistake of fact defense? That is, assuming, irrespective of whether it was specifically required in this case, do we have before us a case in which the judge was focused on the issue of sexual intercourse and not on the question of mistake of fact with respect to touching?
The military judge was focused on what he believed the defense's case to be as of actual consent. And I believe during discussion of a separate instruction on page 68 of the joint appendix, he states, but clearly the defense throughout here was, if this occurred, it was consensual. And so the military judge was not focused on the mistake of fact instruction, did not clearly understand the law as it applied there, because in his mind, at that point, it hadn't been raised.
Counsel, can I draw your attention to page 501 of the transcript, where the victim is, she stated, and then after, I'd say, about 10 minutes, he finally gave up and just stopped. And he said he couldn't believe it took so long, about an hour and a half, for me to keep saying no, and to him finally giving up and he left the room. Doesn't that indicate that during that time period he believed or could have believed that it was consensual and that it took him an hour and a half to finally figure it out?
Your Honor, the government's position is that it took him an hour and a half to realize that through persistence he wasn't going to change her mind, and that's what he said in his statement as well. He's trying to change her mind. He clearly understood that her answer was no, but he thought that through persistence he would get what he wanted, which was sexual intercourse. It took him an hour and a half of sexual advances, which he also states in his statement he knew that she was saying no to, for him to realize that she wasn't going to change her mind.
What about the appellant's argument during the consensual monitoring, the bit about how you usually quit after the first couple of no's, that in the context of this relationship, there's a history of no, no, no banter, or whatever you want to call it?
Well, Your Honor, I point to, again, the fact that this encounter lasted between 45 minutes and an hour and a half, and he even states it took an hour and a half of no's, even if you...
Right, that may go to whether it's a credible argument, but why doesn't that suggest that at least he might have been mistaken at the first no as to whether she was consenting? Because this is only about whether he gets the instruction. It's not about whether he prevails or anybody finds it persuasive.
Yes, sir. The even if you believed after the first couple of no's that she still consented, her testimony is that she was trying to physically resist and get away from him. So it's not just a matter of the fact that she was saying no, but she was also physically resisting and trying to get away from him, re-zipping up her pants whenever he unzipped them, trying to pull her hands out from where he was holding them over her head. So in the context of the relationship where she testified that in the past when she said no, he had stopped, the fact that he knew from his statement that she was saying no and that she was continuing to resist all of his advances, and her testimony that she was physically resisting, there's nowhere in there that is some evidence of appellant's subjective state of mind.
Well, what about his statement in the transcript of from the consensual monitoring that, you know, that what he feels, that what he's apologizing for is for bruising her?
Yes, Your Honor.
Because he didn't realize that he was bruising her, but he's not apologizing for doing something that she didn't want him to do.
Right, Your Honor. The government doesn't contend that apology is for any type of assault, but she said you left bruises, and he said, oh, I didn't think I left bruises. It has nothing to do with whether or not he thought she was consenting to his sexual activities. It has to do with whether or not he thought, in addition to trying to get her to change her mind, persisting for an hour and a half, despite her saying no, that whether or not he'd actually physically harmed her as well. The record here does give us insight as to appellant's subjective state of mind. And so the government's contention is not that the record is absent. It is present in both his statement and in the phone call, as well as from an understanding of the previous relationship as she had testified to. Appellant clearly did understand that Edie did not consent to this behavior, but he thought he could change her mind through persistence.
How do we deal with the subjective state of mind situation in the context of the constitutional and statutory rights of an accused to not testify?
Your Honor, under Jones, clearly the accused and his constitutional rights, clearly the appellant did not have to testify. However, in order to get an affirmative defense instruction, the evidence has to be raised in some way. It can be raised by the government, it can be raised by the defense, it can be raised by the court martial itself. But if it comes time for the defense to present their case, and some evidence has not to that point been presented, and they want the benefit of an affirmative defense and the ability to receive this instruction, then clearly it's got to come from somewhere.
Well, I'm having some difficulty in trying to reconcile the objective and subjective prongs in a situation where a person doesn't testify. Is it the government's position that you can't infer the subjective prong from the objective situation before you?
Yes, Your Honor. The government...
So why isn't that then a requirement to testify?
Your Honor, because in this case we do have subjective evidence of his subjective belief that came and he didn't testify. He gave a statement to NCIS that was presented. There is the transcript of the phone call. We have a conversation about their previous relationship. If any of those had gone the other way, if in his statement he had said, I thought that she was consenting. If the previous relationship evidence had been that in the past she would say no, he would say, oh, come on, and it would continue, and that happened, if in the phone call he had said, well, that's the way it always was. You always said no, and it was okay. I didn't know that you really meant no this time. Any of those things would have provided exactly the evidence that appellant is trying to read into those statements. But I mean, the fact of the matter is we do have subjective evidence. It just doesn't say what the appellant wishes to say.
Can I ask it just a different way to make sure? You just answered this question. I'm asking it again. I understand that. If her testimony was, yes, we sat on the bed, and I could tell he thought I was consenting by the way he acted. Are you saying then, would that be some evidence? Or are you saying it doesn't matter what she said because his statement negates it?
Your Honor, that could be another possible way in which it is raised. The evidence can be raised in a number of different ways, but it has to be affirmatively raised. You can't just assume or
say. In my lousy hypothetical, though, you would agree that would constitute some evidence warranting the instruction?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I just wanted to understand the relationship between the, okay. So the fact that he also says in the statement, she didn't consent, that would go to whether it was a credible defense, but not as to whether there was some evidence warranting an instruction.
Yes, Your Honor, although in this circumstance, because there is, again, everything that appellant has pointed to requires some kind of inference or assumption or supposition to try to find it to be some evidence of the subjective.
No, I understand that. I'm just trying to make sure I understand your argument about the relationship between the statement and her testimony. And I'm trying to make up her testimony to avoid you having to then argue the facts rather than the law.
Yes, sir.
Counsel, was there any evidence here of the mixed message that the defense counsel referenced in his closing statement?
They're not beyond the point where he flipped her on her back and pinned her wrist down and she was physically resisting and stating no. There is no evidence presented by either side that at that point there was any, beyond that, any objective or subjective mistake of fact. The evidence.
And after that time, there wasn't any of the horseplay or laughing or anything?
Not as reflected in the record. No. Without an affirmative statement by appellant or clear and affirmative circumstantial evidence which would allow appellant to honestly and in good faith believe that E.G. consented, this court is left only with inference, assumption, and supposition, but no evidence. Without any evidence, the appellant subjectively honestly thought that E.D. was consenting to his sexual advances, his sexual activity, the mistake of fact instruction is not warranted. If there are no further questions, that concludes my argument.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the defense, do you have rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
And would you address specifically the point made by the government that in the statement that he gave to NCIS, there's nothing in there that would raise some evidence as to mistake of fact as consent?
Yes, Your Honor. As I think I referenced earlier, in that statement, he says, I came to understand she was not going to change her mind. That's some evidence that members could look at and interpret to mean what had happened previous to that was what he believed to be something consensual. And then once he reached that realization point that this is not going anywhere, we need to stop, that's when he stopped his sexual activity.
You are, the government, I believe, argued that her testimony is interesting or whatever, but it all relates to conduct which occurred before he was holding her down on the bed by her wrists, and that the charge, in fact, goes to the conduct after that. And what's your response to that?
That's incorrect, Your Honor. The charge includes the kissing and fondling of the breasts, which by the victim's own testimony occurred prior to the holding of the wrist. She did consensually kiss him, and he did fondle and kiss her breasts prior to that. And then taking the holding of the wrist is a significant event, which I think, perhaps looking from the outside, I think it's important to look at the record and see what happened after that. After he flips her over and holds her wrist, That's when he starts joking with her and begging and offering her children in marriage and to be able to drive his car if she would engage in sexual activity with him. At that point, she starts laughing.
So your argument is there's some evidence before and after in any event?
Yes, Your Honor. So even after the wrist holding, which could conceivably be significant, you've got evidence, very credible evidence, actually, that this was still a consensual give and take because the victim is still laughing and joking with the appellant. I think it's also important to reference that the finders of fact, the members, they're free to find their own timeline as well and give whatever weight and credit, and the government referred to this, the defense's case being based on suppositions and assumptions. Well, those are suppositions and assumptions that a properly instructed members panel can make. That's within the province, but they weren't able to make that in this case because the instruction was not given to them. It's unclear. There's some reference to the 45 to 60 minute time frame for this entire incident. Other than the initial kissing, taking the shirt off, and flipping and pointing the wrist and joking after that, it's unclear what really occurs after that, other than there's something going on. The government counsel referenced when the victim finally kneed the appellant. I think the evidence is pretty clear that after she kneed him, a pretty unambiguous action, that's when it stopped, or at least that sexual advance stopped. Important to reference, which I didn't mention in the first portion of my argument, is that after this all occurred and after this stopped, he got up and then at that point asked her for oral sex, and she said she would bite it off, and then he laughed because he thought she was joking. So he interpreted it to be, okay, finally I can't have any sexual intercourse, but maybe perhaps there can still be more, which affirms upon his subjective belief. I see that I am out of time. If there are no further questions, this concludes my argument.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument for this morning. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation. Court will stand in recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.
All rise. Court stands in recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow.